Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. On today's episode, I speak with Robin Lansong, who shares her incredible story of survival and how it culminated and cultivated in her serving others.
And my then husband, when we got back in the vehicle, he said, "If you could change it and go back and never have gotten abducted, would you?" And I said, "No, because it made me who I am. It broke me down to break me open. And, you know, my intuition, my ability to see people is the gift of my healing process."
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I'm your host, Luis Mojica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music. And then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. Today's episode is an amazing story of resilience. A woman who experienced serious childhood trauma and miraculously survived several experiences so that she could eventually serve and be of service and teach and help others. What really moves me about Robin is her sense of innocence. And I'm always so excited and inspired by people who have been through such pain and emerge with such love and innocence intact. It's a real reminder that we are not our traumas. These things happen to us. These things may be done to our bodies, but they aren't who we are. And they really don't define us once we learn how to relate to the part of us that still echoes and reverberates the events. And Robin really speaks to that, and her work speaks to that. I wanted to direct us now at this part of the episode to her work, robinlansong.com. It is there you can find her healing work, her healing circles,
upcoming courses. She's writing a book, and she has these beautiful blankets that are woven with her art on them. So a lot of amazing ways to work with her or experience what she gives to the world. So let's go into the episode. And I want to welcome Robin Lansong. Thank you for being here.
My honor. I'm really excited for this conversation.
Me too. My wife, about a month ago, I think, maybe a little longer, somehow found your story. She was looking at near-death experiences and listening to different stories. And she heard yours and she was really moved by it. Then she told me, I was really moved by it. And I thought, I really want to meet this person and have them on my podcast. And I was so honored to be able to take place in last night's healing. For those of you listening, Robin does these incredible five-person group. It's such a, I don't even know what to call it. What would you call it? Then I'll say how I experienced it.
It's my singing medicine five-person group.
Beautiful. And mm-hmm. It's so unique because, so you're with five people and everyone has like 10, 15 minutes to kind of share where they are, what they're going through. And as we're sharing, Robin is just intuitively drawing, you know, whatever's coming out of her body that she's feeling from you. And these beautiful shapes and kind of cosmic patterns I'm looking at that right now. Those of you watching this on YouTube can see these. If you're listening to the podcast, you can hop on YouTube and see some of these. They're gorgeous. Yeah, these are the ones from last night. Mm-hmm. And they're so cosmic and everyone related to them so deeply. So that was so unique to share where you are in life, what you're going through, and have someone visually reflect back to you what they're feeling in their body. So gorgeous, so unique. I've never experienced that before. And then the song comes through your body. And then Robin would sing a song to us. We lay back and, you know, receive it. And it obviously does something to your system and it's incredible. And then you speak about how you feel after the song. And then she kind of updates the image. And it was just really gorgeous. And before we go into the work you do, that was like a teaser for those of us listening. I really want you to tell us your story because it's profound. And so why don't you start by introducing yourself and telling us your story and we'll go from there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So I'm Robin Aisha Lansong. And in childhood, when I was 8 years old, it was 1977. I wasn't a protected child. I like to speak of, especially the more I do this work, of generational interruption, and that all parents have the biological desire to protect their children. So when that's not happening, there's been some kind of generational disruption in our basic mammal instinct to protect our young. So of course, you know, some parents don't protect their children or even harm their children. So unfortunately, I was in one of those families where I wasn't being protected, I was being harmed. And so one of the pedophiles that I was exposed to was, you know, not in a good mental state. And I have reason to believe it's possible that he might have been a Vietnam vet. And so he abducted me and he actually took me out of the country, which is easier than people think. In 1977, there weren't even any laws around child abduction in the government yet. Child protection services were just being developed. So there really wasn't systems in place to track children. And so he actually was taking me to the Rhodesian War, which is now Zimbabwe. And he was very dangerous. My life was in danger with him every moment. And it's an odd thing to say that it's almost fortunate that I was an abused child, because I knew how to strategize. And my nervous system knew how to like be silent and get quiet and be really shut down to try and figure out how to survive this. And then also I was born highly intuitive. And then, as we know, abuse can really open up intuition to a hypervigilant state so that we can figure out like what's going on in that person, how to anticipate their next move. So he assaulted me, broke my ribs, and I was hospitalized. And he came and got me from the hospital. Again, no protection services, so he just came and picked me up and he actually ended up giving me to another man, a Black African man. And from there, I was transported on a bus, and the bus broke down. I don't know the nature of their exchange. It's unlikely that he was selling me. but maybe just giving him to get rid of me. And because he was now past his time of training and had to go into the field to fight. So I think, you know, I don't think he had thought through, like, what is he going to do with me once he had to go into battle.
And this man who abducted you, was he from Africa or is he American?
He's a white American. Mm-hmm. So I got left behind when the bus broke down. I was actually, and so here I am, I'm 8 years old, my ribs are broken, my painkillers are wearing off. I'm out in the bush in Zimbabwe, and I think, okay, this is how I'm going to die. This is the end of my 8 miserable years. What happened a few hours later is that soldiers came by, and they were fully armed, and I thought, this is how I'm going to die, and it's going to be a lot faster. And at that point, you know, I had no desire to live. And so they picked me up and took me to a place that I now understand was a place that was so dangerous that, you know, not even armed soldiers would go there. And so again, my life was in danger. And what I like to get across in telling this is that it's one of the soldiers, one of the kind of extreme soldiers, who chose to go against the other soldiers and save my life. And so what's true is that it's the enemy that saved my life. Mm. And he chose to risk saving a white child, which put him at extreme risk for himself. And so he snuck me out of there and transported me again, which is using gasoline, which was a huge resource, and took me to a village that I think he thought would be sympathetic to a white child. And so I hid myself in a tree and just made it through a night by myself. And in the morning, it was the women singing in this village. And they were grinding the cornmeal and they were singing. And the part of me that still felt some life in me wanted to connect to that life. To, like, how are these women singing while they work? What is their life force? And I wanted to get closer to that. But as you know, like, you know, children have all this conflict of, like, I need food, I need shelter, I need mothering. But what's my safety level? Like, what if they harm me more? So there was that incredible conflict of going forward, but holding back. So they spotted me and brought me food and water. And eventually I got welcomed into this village. And it was really the children who welcomed me, and they came over, and I wasn't threatened by children. So I let them touch my white skin. And then my hair was blonde, and so it was my first experience of belonging with these children. They took me to the fire circle. I couldn't understand their language, of course, but I could understand their caring and that they were covering me in black ash to make me look more like them. And so all the children joined in and covered me in black ash and told a story about how I arrived, and, you know, with gestures and kind of pointing to me. And it was the first experience of belonging, of being wanted in my whole life. And then one of the women sang to me. And so she came over and she was singing and she was calling me to her and she was singing to me. And it was nourishing the frozen, hardened child that I was. It was softening me. It was feeding me into places that I couldn't otherwise have received. And so she sang me so close to her that I finally just collapsed in her arms. And it was really the first mothering I had ever received in my 8 years. And so I stayed with her, and really these people welcomed me, and they were teaching me their songs, teaching me how to help grow the corn. And I became part of them, which was a risk for them. You know, to harbor a white child was putting them at risk of either being accused of abducting me from the white government or being accused of siding with the enemy from the most extreme soldiers. And so what happened, you know, I didn't know there was a war going on, and I just thought, this is my new family, this is my new life. And one day I wandered too far from kind of the center of the village, and unbeknownst to me, there was a battle starting. And one of the soldiers who was kind of scanning the perimeter spotted me, and immediately raised up his rifle and chose to pull the trigger. And the bullet grazed the top of my head, blew me off my feet, and I began to die of blood loss. And so I crossed over through veils and through veils, and I went over to the other side, and I met all these beings that purified me. They purified me of thinking that there was something wrong with me, that the abuse was my fault, and really showed me the beauty of my own soul. And I was going home to what I call the great heart, to where I believe I was sung into being by this great heart, that I was a seed syllable sung into being. And I was going home to this great source, to my original creator. And in the meantime, my African mother, my Mam Yatan, had found my body. And she had, and I was looking down from above, I could see her from above. And she was holding my lifeless body and stopping the blood flow. And she was wailing at first. And then her wailing turned into singing. And then she called on the ancestors in the land to sing a calling song to find me so I could find my way back home, back to my body. And once she joined in with the ancestors, that song was so powerful. It went through the veils that had closed behind me. And it touched me where I was on the other side, in the tunnel going home to the great heart. And when that song touched me, I remembered I hadn't done my purpose, which was to sing to people as she was singing to me, to help call people back to their belonging, to their remembering that they're part of creation, part of nature, part of humanity. And so I, in that moment of remembering, that turned me around. I could have gone home to the great heart, but it turned me around in the tunnel, and I came back to life, came back to my body, and came back to really to her love. And from there, there was much more trauma. And when I was right at the cusp of coming back, I met what I believe and call as the grandmother of all of us. And she had black skin, and her eyes changed to the color of all of us. And she told me, it's going to be difficult when you go back. There's going to be much that's going to harm you and hurt you deeply. And I want you to always remember that you belong here no matter what anyone does to you. No matter what you have to do to survive, you always belong home here. And she sang inside me like I was a cathedral. And she was singing inside this cathedral. And she said, go back, do your part, sing to people to help them remember. And so that was my final gift before I came back. And it was much more difficulty. The soldiers came back, attacked the village, and the village was massacred. And it is possible that I'm the only one that survived. I ran and I escaped and I fell down again because the blood had started again. And I had a second death experience. And this time I met a being who was so powerful. And with one hand, he could do creation, and with the other hand, he could do destruction. And he was a blue being. He was masculine and feminine. And he had a black bun on the top of his head. And he told me and he taught me, it is destruction that breaks open the ingredients to make new creation. And he showed me an image of creating a mountain out of colliding two land masses. And that over time, that mountain would disintegrate to make the beaches. And he said, you know, do you love the mountain and the beaches? And I said, I do, but I don't like the destruction part. Can I have both without the destruction? And he said, no, it's the breaking apart of things that we thought were solid that makes the new creation. The mountain makes the beaches. And so I said, I understand. And he said, you're human. You understand right now. But when I send you back, you'll forget again. So I'll be here to remind you. And so he sent me back. He gave me the strength to crawl away. And I was found the next day by a woman who I now know, her name is Mia Lucy. And so she found me. I was dying. And she cleared off the blood. She took me back to her homestead. And when people saw that she had a wounded white child, they said, don't bother with her. It's too dangerous. And she said, she's a living human being. I won't throw her away. And so again, it's the courage, the altruism, the innate drive for her to protect me because I was a child that is the reason I'm not just another number of deceased in that war, and that I'm here. And that it drives my mission to be of service, to give back, because in all my work, it's about giving forward the love, the courage that they gave to me to save my life, to pay that forward in as many ways as I can. From there, I was given over to white people in South Africa. And then from there, I was taken to a hospital in Polokwane, South Africa. And again, it's 1977. I was in a whites-only hospital. So I went from being completely touched and sung to and held and loved, you know, in this Black African community, to suddenly being in a whites-only apartheid hospital where I wasn't touched, I wasn't sung to. They took my dress away. They, you know, told me it's so good now, you're not with those Black people anymore. And I couldn't even find words to express to them. Like, I was being loved. I was being cared for. I want to go back. And so from there, it was figured out, like, where that my family back in the U.S. And I was transported back on a plane and given back to my parents, which was traumatic to be all of a sudden back into a family of abuse and neglect and not able to speak of it. And, you know, if I tried to speak of it, they, you know, don't ever talk about this again. So as we know, our ability to survive can give us this incredible capacity to shut down, to repress, to put away, and to compress all of that happened inside my nervous system, inside my tissue and my body. And that didn't start coming out. When I was a teenager, it basically started coming out as stress. And I literally was going into parasympathetic shock. I was passing out, going numb, to the point where I didn't have a detectable heart rate, and I had to be resuscitated many times. So I had several more death experiences from literally collapsing from stress, that the cortisol can eat away at the heart and make it so we go into such a deep state of shutdown, we're not breathing and having a heartbeat. So I did a tremendous amount of healing once I got away from my family when I was 19, and, you know, then began like a very intense trauma resolution. And so all the way up until I was from 19 to 35, it's kind of all I did was trauma resolution, body work, you know, every modality you can think of. EMDR therapy was really a huge saving grace for me, as well as all the body work, movement, yoga, breath work that I did. Adrenal support was a huge transformative moment for me too. And then, you know, at 35, I went to massage school, and that was when I was able to start giving back. And what I loved about being able to not just be focused on my own healing was that place of giving back, we're able to see our own goodness, our own agency in our ability to be of service to others. And so I know you know this also, of just every time we can help somebody else's transformation, somebody else's healing, it shows us, you know, one, that our own work was worth it, and two, the power of being able to bring that work forward and really know what to say to somebody in a moment when they need compassion. So I'm just incredibly grateful for what comes through me, the singing medicine, the art, in a way to be of service to other people's healing process.
It's just so, you know, so incredible, everything you're saying. I mean, your story is so amazing. There's no other word for it. I mean, it's beyond words. There's so many parts of it that were so touching. I would say it was so touching to me that I'm seeing this image of this little girl up in a tree, like, you know, broken ribs, having escaped these two situations that are terrifying. And then you're hearing this song, you're hearing this singing, and something in you recognized the life in that woman. And it created this curiosity and even maybe desire for life. That's really powerful for me as a somatic therapist, because my whole purpose in what I teach and try to embody and practice is releasing understanding and picking up sensation and experience, right? So for you to be in that tree and just have the visceral, somatic, and spiritual experience of the song, kind of like awakening your little bit of desire to live that was in there. I almost hear like her song nurtured your own life force. Is that how it was experienced?
Yes, very much. And it took, like, when she was standing right in front of me, very close, and literally just bringing me in to have this, you know, iceberg, internal iceberg, just begin to crack and soften. And just, it's the calming, the honesty in a human voice that, you know, as you know, like, we're all looking for welcome or warning. And of course, my vigilance was looking for, like, how can she harm me? But it was the sweetness, the softness, the invitation in her singing that allowed my being to literally just collapse in her arms, to let her be my mama, to let her be my shelter, to let her be my parent.
What I find so important about what you just said was, you know, I talk a lot about the word safety as in a biological state, something inside of you. And there are these people and beings and experiences outside of us that can kind of awaken our safety, right? And in my field, we call that co-regulation, right? Like something in me finds safety in something in you. So when you're telling me about how there's the welcome or warning, you know, which I love that distinction, I often call that the expectation of threat, right? When you're so traumatized, the body's just expecting and waiting for threat, and that's that hypervigilance. Your little 8-year-old body was so overcoupled at that point by the experience of human beings equal threat. So to have this human being who was awakening a physical sensation of safety in you, I mean, it must have been profound and also strange because that was unfamiliar to you. Mm-hmm. So it just the feeling of safety, I'm imagining, took some time to build capacity to even trust. Is that right?
Oh, I mean, it was, you know, I don't know how many minutes of her singing to me where I would just, like, you know, a tiny step forward because she was, you know, literally beckoning me. And, you know, and then I got close enough that she put a hand on my shoulder, which, of course, you know, then I wanted to run. But the singing was so soothing and so honest. And I could just see nothing in her face, you know, in her body language that was about threat. And so, as you know, that desire to be connected, you know, is sometimes in conflict with that desire to be safe. But the desire to be connected and sheltered overcome. And that's when I literally, like, to lean my body and just step closer to the singing, because it was resonating me. It was vibrating inside me. And I wanted more of that, even though it was, you know, I thought I might blow apart.
Mm-hmm.
What will happen if I relax?
Yes.
What will happen if I let myself be sheltered by her?
I think that's what's so profound about your story in particular, is you found safety, first of all, in another culture, in another land, in another world, essentially, and after near-death experiences. And what I love about the way this happened for you was that I almost imagine, because you were in a village of people from a different land, different tribe, different language, you didn't have actually the experience of identity, for instance, right? Someone couldn't say, oh my gosh, you're hurt. You couldn't understand that. So all your body could do was decipher the tonalities. And there's almost like a gift, isn't it, in relinquishing the identity of what had been done to you for just the simple vibrations of safety and the touch. And, you know, does that make sense? I'm curious what that was like for you.
Yes, very much. Because there's no mirrors. I forgot I was white.
Yes, yes.
No, so I just, you know, everybody I'm seeing, I just became part of what was there.
Yes.
And what's interesting, and I write about this a lot in my upcoming book, is I could understand them more because they spoke with their body, because they spoke with their hands, than when I got with the Afrikaners, the white South Africans. I couldn't understand them as much because they were speaking Afrikaans, which is a derivative of Dutch. But they didn't talk with their hands. They didn't talk with their body. They didn't talk with their gestures. So I had no idea what they were communicating. Whereas, you know, I learned some things in terms of I didn't learn Venda, but I learned the communication. I learned the gesturing. Mm-hmm. And so I felt much safer there than when I was with white people in South Africa.
Which is really profound, again, because I often say that the language of the body is sensation. And that language is, it's a pagan language. It's an earth-based, nature-based, body-based language. It's not necessarily culture-based. Each culture has obviously different language and song. But the culture of the body itself is like that of the animal, of the element, water, and it's vibrational. So when I hear you say they moved with their bodies, and I'm sure their songs came in a much more guttural way from their bodies, there's something your body recognized in that, even though it was a completely different culture from yours. And mm-hmm. I find that so gorgeous and touching.
Mm-hmm. And as you say that, it kind of helps me connect too about, so the singing medicine that I do now is really listening to the land where I am. And so since I've lived on the West Coast, I'm listening to the song that's in the land. And when I was doing a ceremony, a native ceremony where all races were welcome, and I got shown the kind of the original source of where the singing that comes through me is from the ancient animals in the ocean. So the ammonoids, which are kind of, they look like nautilus, but they're before nautilus. And I had a vision during this dance ceremony that I was hearing the song that they sung to each other in the ocean. And that when the land rose up and they became fossils, there's still that song that they sing to each other in the land. And so that's what I was shown is the original source of what I'm singing, is those singing back and forth to each other from the primordial ocean. And when I sang at this native ceremony, some people would say, well, it sounds like early Hopi, or it sounds like the root language, you know, in many Native American cultures. And so I believe I'm listening to the same source of how people developed language, you know, in this whole West Coast area. And so if I go to Florida and I'm there long enough, the songs shift because I'm listening to the song that's in the land there. Mm-hmm. And also when I'm singing to people as part of the healing, my prayer is, my request is, may I hear the original song that they were born with, and may that come through my voice. So I'm really just the hollow bone. It's really my job to surrender, to allow that instructions from people and the instructions from the land to come through me. And, you know, especially when I do live groups where I sing to about 15 to 20 people, you know, afterwards, I just feel so humbled. Like, this gets to be my job. This gets to be my work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I do the art, it's like, again, I'm just surrendering. I'm being the hollow bone. And I just think, how lucky am I that I get to have this magnitude of gift come through me? And kind of in that ceremony that I was speaking of, at the end of the ceremony, we were called to just sit down and do prayer and like literally call out our prayers of all our gratitudes, which is pretty incredible to have like 150 people just all yelling out their gratitudes. Mm-hmm. And just my gratitude for the art, the singing medicine to come through me. Literally, I was just on my knees weeping with how fortunate I am. And that's one of my big lessons for getting across to people is when we reduce the trauma content in our body, in our nervous system, we can allow the gift to arise. And that's, you know, let alone to have joy or choice or freedom. You know, and of course, better relationships. When we can empty ourselves of trauma content, we can allow ourselves more beautifully to be that hollow bone.
I mean, there's so many things that are so gorgeous. It's interesting. I have a record coming out called Songs from the Land. And so I have the exact experience as you. That's not true. I have an experience probably very similar to yours, not exact, where there is this song that the land is singing. Always. And the work I've done with natives and non-native peoples, I learned from people who are very earth-based, how even the lineage of native language comes from sounds that terrain made, the way the rain fell in the pond, the way their feet lifted off of the snow. And so it was this relationship through listening And it's a decolonial relationship, if you will, around instead of dominating with what I think it is, I'm waiting for it to tell me its name. And so when you're talking about being the hollow bone, that's essentially what you're talking about, is you're there and your job is to relate to what's around you and let it move through you. And I think what I find so important about your story, I don't know if I have the math right. I think you said, okay, 19 is when you left home, or 17?
19.
20. And you said 34 was when you found massage and you started being able to serve?
Yeah, I received, like, the things that were included in my trauma resolution were talk therapy, and then eventually I found EMDR therapy, which was so much more effective for me because I'm so visual. And of course, I did craniosacral acupuncture. I received massage, did yoga, tai chi, you know, pretty much everything, you know, tried to eat a non-inflammatory diet. And so by about, I think, yeah, about when I was 35, I felt well enough to start to be of service. Mm-hmm. And then also my intuition was just getting bigger and bigger. And I was not just using it for hypervigilant scanning for danger anymore. I was starting to hear and see inside people. And so I hear and see people's organs. I see people's history in their tissue, in their nervous system. And so I was starting to trust it more and test it out with people more and find out, like, oh, you know, this is actually accurate and useful, but I need training in physiology to match up. Like, well, in that area, I see this distress, but I don't know what organ is there or what, how that relates to somebody's life. Mm-hmm. So I purposely went to massage school with the most training in physiology so I could get the most anatomy. And that would help me match up my intuition with my training so that I could really know, like, if I'm seeing this in somebody's liver, you know, here's how that's going to show up in their skin or their, you know, their anger outburst or their heat. And so I've just continued for, you know, like you, for years of just getting more and more nervous system training, more brain training, more physiology training, so that I can really refine that matchup for people. Like, love this that. Goes with this. This experience goes with your gallbladder. Mm-hmm. This experience, you know, that hasn't been expressed goes with your digestive system.
I think that's so, what I love about, two things I love about that is, first, I like to just highlight, it was a good 15 years, you know, from the moment of leaving your family's home where there was, I mean, talking 19, 20 years of abuse and trauma. So leaving that situation and then 15 years until you felt like you were able to serve. I just have to say that for a lot of people listening, because a lot of, as you know, too, as a practitioner, people come to us, they might discover these intense traumas and they might discover how their body's holding them. And then they expect resolution in like a couple months. And and I remember feeling the same way. And it was a good 15 years for me too, until I really felt like, oh, now I have the capacity to use my experience so I can actually guide someone else's experience. Because there is a great wisdom in trauma. Once, like you said, once it metabolizes and you're not in the fight or flight all the time, you're left with all this somatic, you know, spiritual wisdom. Because I see trauma as being very connected to life force, you know, God, Goddess, Spirit. It's this incredible being that moves through you and creates a survival apparatus beyond your consent, right? Like, it's something so much bigger than you, moving you out of danger. And when you live in that for a while, it's like you're literally connected like an IV drip to source, but it's too much. And then when you start metabolizing it and you feel that safety, like you were describing, then you kind of like get to integrate the wisdom as well. So I just like to say that so people listening can realize, wow, if you're just starting your healing journey, the first step I always say is just to indulge your own needs. And then when you have that capacity, you'll find a way to serve from that place. Whether it's as a therapist or practitioner or just someone that loves watering a garden, like, you'll find a way to serve. I wonder if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I agree. When I first was, I went to an inpatient trauma treatment unit, like a 30-day program. And then I got out of that one and I went into another 30-day inpatient trauma treatment program. And then I went to an extended care. And I remember when I was in the extended care, I could I could get out and go to a library. I had some more freedom. And I looked up, like, for my magnitude of trauma, how long was it going to take? And it said 3 to 5 years in this textbook. And I was so mad. I was like, 3 to 5 years? I'm on the 2-year plan, thank you. Yeah. Like, I got things to do. I want to, like, you know, go hiking and stuff. I want to go have fun. Like, little did I know, I was on a 15-year plan.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, taking breaks, doing, you know, other life things, it's when you can. And one of the things I just really love about what you said, and I hope gets incorporated in the psychology field, is to stop just pathologizing trauma. You know, like the terms like abreaction and like failure to thrive and all these things that blame our nervous system. Mm-hmm. Like when I was in my, in one of the trauma treatment units, and they gave me this whole, you know, tons and tons of tests. And I remember sitting, having this, you know, PhD psychologist sitting across from me. And he said, your post-traumatic stress score is off our chart. You know, and he was looking at me like, I don't know if we can help you. And he didn't have faith. He didn't have faith in me. He didn't have faith in healing because he was too much in his head. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but you're wrong. I'm going to make it. And then his next statement after your PTSD is off the chart is, it shows you have a poor ability to handle stress. Of course, I wanted to punch him, which I knew would just add, you know, belligerent and violent to my file, so I didn't. And I just thought, your test makers cannot comprehend the magnitude of strength I have to make it through what I did. They might be dead, your test makers. Your people who decided I have a poor ability to stress might not have made it. And the disrespect in that moment, and just my, of course, my recoil of like, not only do you get me, not only do you not respect me, but you have no idea what healing is about.
And that's where that's where that all comes from, right? Like the not respect to you, not being able to see you, it blossoms from literally a different culture of healing, right? It's like you said it really great. It's a culture of pathologizing trauma, seeing it as the enemy, when really it's like an extremely sacred being that protects you. And it's kind of like, if we're able to start shifting to, well, actually your nervous system's doing the right thing. You know, it created all this hypervigilance and stress and adrenaline to save you. It just didn't realize it was allowed to stop. And that's so much more innocent, right? And so much more compassionate than labeling and identifying something as if it's going to be permanent now. You know, like you're permanently ridden with PTSD. It's like, no, in this moment, my body's expressing threat. But what if it updated to the fact that it's actually safe right now? What would happen then? Right. And that takes a very unique person, right. Right, to think that way. Someone that has gone through literally hell and back as you have. And to do that, your actual life, every breath is like a testament to transformation. And that's very different than treatment. Transformation is different than treatment. And so... So I find that to be really important.
Mm-hmm. And I remember I was having a conversation with Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score. And I'd done a week-long workshop with him, training with him. And at the end, I said, you know, what's needed? And he just looked at me and he said, you know, and of course he had worked with me and he knew my story now from being in the group. And he said, Robin, people just need hope. And like, just give them hope that healing is possible. And so just for how people even get started. And so that's, you know, so much what I love about why I believe I was saved, why I believe that, you know, that being I was speaking of that had destruction in one hand and creation in the other, my perception is that Shiva, and that Shiva brought me back and saved me just to give hope of like you're saying, trauma is part of the human experience. It's not something that's going to go away. Like being broken down to be broken open is like, we don't know what we're made of unless we're like right at the edge. Mm-hmm. And so again, not just calling this, oh, that never should have happened. When I was in Zimbabwe and I went back, I've been back twice, and I found the field, you know, where the village was, where the massacre happened. And my then husband, when we got back in the vehicle, he said, if you could change it and go back and never have gotten abducted, would you? And I said, no, because it made me who I am. It broke me down to break me open. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my intuition, my ability to see people is the gift.
That's right.
Of my healing process. I don't necessarily say it's the gift of just the raw trauma. I say it's the gift to myself of my healing process.
That's right.
So taking that responsibility for our healing process, being in that agency to say, you know, the abusers, the trauma, it isn't going to change my life. I am.
That's right.
I'm the one showing up. I'm the one making the choices to go to yoga, to get the massage, to prioritize, you know, like all my money went to my healing process.
I had no savings for many, 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 many years. I still have very little savings, but I had no savings for a long, long time because literally every cent went straight toward supporting my body and nervous system and healing. That's all I cared about. Because like you, I thought, well, my only purpose here is to do things that help me reconnect and feel better. I'm not even going to look beyond that. Like no logical realm is going to work now for me. It just has to be about following this thing in me that feels very broken, but this other thing in me that feels very whole. And how do I connect to that more?
Right.
And when you were saying hope, I really wanted to kind of, for myself, redefine that into proof. Because when I hear your story of the woman singing to you, and I've heard your songs, like I've experienced your singing medicine, it's like, I think a lot of us will call that hope, and that's fine, that's beautiful. I really call it proof, because when you're singing and when you were being sung to, it wasn't hope. It was like you actually felt the reality of safety and life in you being awakened. And that's huge. And I think that's why I love somatic work so much, because we're not talking about strategies. We're actually doing exercises or situations that in real time, even for those listening to this episode, will feel in their body. We're not just telling them a story to believe in. We're saying, where do you feel it? As I sing, which you're about to in a little bit for us, as we talk about this, as we kind of redefine some of these things, what part of your body, listeners, wakes up to that? That's something we often, again, label as hope, but that's actually already in you. It's just about exactly what you said. Now you're allowed to respond to that. You're allowed to nurture that and do things that support that to get bigger. And that's the real power for the traumatized, is the event has nothing to... I speak in very sometimes dramatic, you know, terms. So the event has a lot to do with the trauma, but the event itself isn't the traumatization. It's the reverberation of the event, right? Because if it was just the event, we'd all be fine after it happened, but the event keeps reverberating. So our ability to relate and respond to that reverberation, that's what's so powerful in shifting the inner biology, you know, and I think the spiritual mechanism that is trauma.
Mm-hmm. And I'm love that. I'm totally going to use that. I'm going to stop saying hope. I'm going to say proof. and just also kind of adding in with that of when people have spiritual experiences, when they have that awakening through their body. And I love Daniel Siegel calls intuition, wisdom in the body. And when people have their own direct mystical experience, just like you're saying, they no longer have to look to authority outside of themselves to know. It's their own way, direct way of knowing.
That's right.
And that's the other part of my work that I love, is in sharing my death experiences, that it helps other people learn to trust their own mystical experiences. And I'll just share, a little while ago, I just moved to Mount Shasta, California, and I was about to do a live talk sharing my whole death experience in detail. And so there was a poster up on the room and, you know, in this building, and I was coming up the stairs with all my art, and these two men who were just in the office building, they went past the poster, and on the steps, like as they're walking towards me, they're making fun of near death experiences and, like, you know, making fun of me. And I'm not hurt. I'm totally fine. I know who I am. And so they get to the bottom of the stairs, and I said, oh, you think that's, you know, pretty silly about that person sharing their near-death experience. And they're like, yeah, we do. And I said, hi, I'm Robin Lansong, and I'm going to be sharing my death experience. And, you know, the look on their face of like, oh my gosh, we socially messed up. And literally in like the next breath, the man starts telling me about the head-on collision he had from a drunk driver. And that he's had a death experience.
Is that amazing?
And so, you know, even just him seeing my poster and that the fact that I'm going to go openly speak publicly about it, my hope is that that gave him more permission to own his own experience. And just to see his body change when he got that across to me. Because, you know, instantly knew it's like, she knows it's okay to, it's safe to tell her.
That's really beautiful. And I think that's one reason why I share so many of my experiences, because I think when people know exactly what you've worked through and what you've lived through, it does create this space in them. You know, one of the participants last night said that to you. They said, you know, seeing what you went through, I felt safe coming here. And so there is a safety in the body you can feel when you can relate to or feel moved by someone's experience. So you gave that man who was like laughing, you know, permission to stop laughing at himself, essentially, right? And to be able to say, oh, wow, okay, I'm allowed to be with this. And this being gives me permission to. So I want to switch to the song, because we have to start closing. And I want everyone listening to think about what we were just saying around proof versus hope, and about safety being inside of you. And even reflecting on Robin's story about that safety that started building when the woman was singing to her. So if you want to pause the episode and lay down and then press play again, go for it. But get really comfy so you can just notice, how does my body feel when Robin sings to us? And you can do whatever you want, Robin. You want to introduce what you're going to sing or just sing it. It's completely up to you.
Mm-hmm. So just checking in with your breath, getting curious. Am I breathing in? Am I on the pause? Am I breathing out? What sensations, emotions, images, colors might possibly arise? Shum Om Aho He Am He Aho Om Aham Hai O He Ahi Om Nahi Om Naham Mai Ham O I am ho he hum ne he ham no he ya ho ho we ho I am he ya ho hum ne ham hi Hi. You are good enough. You are beauty born into a human body to live and breathe your unique expression of divine source. You already are whole. There's nothing to fix. There's just revealing your goodness to yourself, your divinity in the world. As you are. Rendez-vous.
Thank you for being with us, Robin.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice, what's your body doing right now? Sit with it. Let it speak to you. And let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. To learn more about my work, you can visit holisticlifenavigation.com and sign up for my mailing list. You'll receive a bi-weekly newsletter with specific monthly topics, free resources, and upcoming events. You can also follow me on Instagram. If you like my podcast, please leave a review and share. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.